Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
That's not Alan Berkus singing, that's Alan Berkus playing. Alan Berkus, a tremendous composer, but also the greatest over 70 basketball player in the world. He's been on the covers of magazines. He's now 82 and he still plays competitively. My new favorite book, ladies and gentlemen, is titled Young Radicals in the War for American Ideals. The author is Jeremy McCarter, who is relatively new to Chicago and who... Hi, Jeremy.
Hi,
how
Rick.
Are you? And he's in the studio right now. He was a big hit at LitFest last week, being interviewed by Sasha Heman. He writes in this book, and tell me you would, even in the introduction, you could stop reading after this first sentence. This is a story about hope and what comes after hope, and despair and what comes after despair. What inspired this book, Mr. McCarter?
It's so long ago, I barely remember.
Well, was it? I mean, I know you've been working on it for 6 years.
Yeah.
I mean, on and off with an interlude to write a book about Hamilton, and we'll talk a little about Hamilton.
It was a winding path.
Yes. Yeah. What inspired it?
So I first found out about this era back when I was in college.
Studying history at Harvard.
Studying history, right? And there was this era right before the United States went into World War I, when suddenly all the engines started roaring at once, politically, socially, culturally. This country started leaping forward. It was America's coming of age. And then overnight, it was gone. When the United States went into World War I, all the countries started falling apart, the repression and the censorship. And this, so it had been in my head for a long time. And around 2011, I finally thought, the only way I'm going to stop thinking about this era is if I can put it on the page. So I started writing it in what now feels like another century.
Yeah, sure.
Because it all changed on election night.
The focus of this radicalism or this creative, radicalism is creative. It's of this creative energy was Greenwich Village.
Yeah.
Give me a portrait of, without mentioning any of the names, mm-hmm. but Greenwich Village, you'd say, I don't have too many notes on this book. I do. I have too many notes on this book right now. This lively, funny, kaleidoscopic bohemia. Expand on that, Jeremy.
Sure. Carter. We think of Greenwich Village now as being the...
Too expensive to live in.
It's too expensive to even walk down the streets anymore.
Right. You're right.
And before that, we think of it as having been this place where, there was the Bob Dylan era village.
Or the Kerouac, even a little further back.
Go back even farther than that, and Greenwich Village wasn't cool. It wasn't fashionable. It was just cheap. It was run down. It's where the rich people had their stables. It's where Italian immigrants lived, and in this hodgepodge neighborhood that never got put onto the grid system of Manhattan, in the first years of the 20th century, all of these fascinating people start to find each other. When you have these poets and these painters and these agitators, these anarchists, and they all start talking to each other and meeting in the cheap restaurants and the cafes, that's when the sparks start to fly. And that, in fact, was the quality that first drew me to this.
Sure.
It was that the political rebels and the art rebels and the social rebels were, in some cases, the same people. And they had this crazy little neighborhood where they could be themselves.
One of the interesting things is you could have selected from that era and that place, let's say a thoughtful dozen characters easily, some of them not exactly the age you focus on here, but Emma Goldman and Ida Tarbell, and I mean Eugene O'Neill, dozens of them. you focus on, and I'm going to have you, if it's okay with you, I literally want you to spend about 5 minutes talking about each one of these people, because some of them I knew, mm-hmm. certainly knew who Walter Lippmann was, and certainly knew John Reed, and any of you who've seen Reds sort right. of know that, you know, John Reed looked like Jack Nicholson, but that's all you know, frankly.
Yeah, Reed was Beatty.
Well, that's right. Reed was Beatty. Of course he was, because it was Beatty's movie. Of course he was. That's right. Yeah, because it was Warren Beatty's movie. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Warren Beatty, the handsomest possible
heroic figure. But in choosing the five you chose, it seems to me, given your book, to be the ideal number. But was that difficult? And I know they're all of a certain age. You sort of, you know, were born in like the 1880s, and by 1912, right. when you sort of start the book, it would have been at the age where they could have been doing something. Was it difficult to winnow that crowd?
Yes. There are outlines and outlines and outlines of this book where each of the five people I ended up with is not on that paper. And there were plenty of others that I tried to fit in. Yeah. I mean, to me, the two things that got me, that made me want to write this book, were that I was very fascinated about this era. It seemed inherently dramatic to me that there's this moment of great promise when the country is leaping forward and then it stops. What do you do if you were one of the people who thought that you were going to help that future get here faster? So it was about the era. But then it was also about the radical inclination. And it wasn't about that era. It was about any era. I have always been fascinated by people who can get out of bed in the morning and know that they are going to suffer that day. Not just work hard, but suffer mm-hmm. for the sake of a better world. Even if they don't need to be bothered yeah. by it. They didn't. Oh. And so what that led me to look for is I wanted to find radicals, not people who wanted to make
define that for me. Define the word for me, will you?
So radical. It's funny because people, we don't think of him this way now, but Woodrow Wilson, who was the president for this era, was considered a radical when he was getting into politics.
Sure.
And they asked
because
him.
Because he had no, like many people, contemporary people, he had very little experience. This was not some lifelong politician there. Right.
Yeah, I know. It seems less crazy now that you could go from like sure nowhere does. To becoming yeah. president really right. quickly, but... this was seemed newsworthy in 1912, but they asked him about his radicalism, and he defined it in a way that stuck with me. Being the former president of Princeton, he gave this scholarly sort of answer, and he said that radical comes from the same root, same word as the roots. So it's about digging down and changing in some fundamental way the way something works. And I was looking for people who weren't trying to adjust the tax rate. It wasn't about saying that we should fund government projects differently.
Right,
I wanted people who were chasing big dreams.
Well, they were chasing, and that's the subtitle. They were chasing this American ideal,
right?
Which is another thing I'm going to ask you to define. I mean, what are these? No, I know you wrote the book.
I did write the book,
Ladies and gentlemen, it is in the book. This is not a. This is just a test to see what Jeremy McCarter remembers of the book. We're going to get into it all. I'm going to read a little something from it, because one of the things about this book, for any of you who think, well, this sounds like a little too academic for me, this is an unbelievably exciting read. And I think in large part because Jeremy, I've not read a lot of his stuff. I've read some of his theater criticism over the years. But this is a very exciting read. Once he selected these five incredibly compelling characters. The life of all their lives are interesting, but right. the life of Walter Lippmann is one of the most astonishing lives of the 20th century. And it is amazing to me how someone of that stature and influence, I could go down in the newsroom, well now no one's down there, tomorrow morning and ask every single person who works in that newsroom, reporters, editors, hey, who's Walter Lippmann? And I would get a big fat zero. I'm talking this entire hour with Jeremy McCarter. We may get into what he's relatively new to Chicago, but he has been to a Cubs game. I don't think he's been to the Billy Goat, but he has been to a Cubs game. His book, Young Radicals in the War for American Ideals, takes place a century ago, and it jumps off the page, as they say, in the lit crit business. Thank you.
it ain't easy getting old.
That's Alan Berkus's most famous song, It Ain't Easy Getting Old, even though he's 81 and he still plays competitive basketball. Jeremy McCarter's here for this whole hour. He was a history major at Harvard, then he got kind of sucked into the theater world as a critic and an arts writer, and then
I recovered.
An arts administrator, and he helped. He got drunk with Lynn Miranda, and they came up with the idea for Hamilton.
No,
and the rest is history.
No,
I know, but it's a good
he
story.
He told me about the idea for
he
Hamilton.
He met with Jeremy, and he told Jeremy of the idea for Hamilton, and Jeremy woke up the next day and said, "Well, it's actually the greatest drunken. Whether you guys were drunk or sober, it's the greatest drunk sober idea of the early 21st century." I'm telling you that the book is much of it takes place in Greenwich Village, set beginning in about 1912, New Year's Day of 1912, specifically because the aforementioned Walter Lippmann did something. But I just. Whatever you may think of the title, Young Radicals and the War for American Ideals, and whatever you may think of the setting, I am going to read you a paragraph that I hope will give you some sense of the exciting, compelling, and narrative drive of this book. This is how Chapter 2 begins, so you'll be into it really quickly. John Reed prowls the docks, laughing with the sailors, chatting up the whores. The big Irish cops know him there, as do the Chinese in Chinatown and the Jews on the Lower East Side. He rides the elevated trains up and down the avenues, hitching up his pants, shouldering into places he doesn't belong. For a snack, he'll sometimes eat a grapefruit, tearing it in half, wolfing down the insides, then wringing the rind like a rag, tilting his chin back so the juice runs down his throat. Overtaken at last by fatigue or morning light, he romps home to ramshackle Greenwich Village, the air around Mrs. Vanderbilt's stables sweet with horse manure. In the grungy apartment that he shares with three friends, he writes down what he'd seen and heard of his adventures. Then he tries to sell it. Reed is a writer, or would like to be. That's a great, as a writer, Jeremy McCarter, that certainly just didn't pour out. I mean, the writing of this book had to be, because it's set, it's present tense too, and that's a conscious effort to not write an academic book, yes?
Right. Well, I would just say, first of all, where were you when I was trying to record the audiobook for this? Because that's much better reading than I managed in front of a microphone.
Stop. I'm sure your audiobook's great.
And the second thing is, having picked these five people and said that they tell a story that's interesting to me, and I hope they will help understand a little better what it means to try to fix the world, then how do you tell that story? And for me, I just thought, I didn't want it to be an academic survey. I didn't want it to be polemical and anoint a winner at the end. I wanted to say these five young Americans led incredible lives. They ran risks. They took chances. They got their hearts broken. They persisted. And part of that was – so then that means it's going to be a story. It's going to have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yes.
It's not going to go one, then the next, then the next. And then it just sort of felt right to tell it in the present tense. It just felt like that was the way to make it feel what I think it really is, which is not something that happened a super long time ago, something that might as well have happened this morning for how timely it is.
You know, in the book, there were a lot of kind of echoes. I mean, I'm a child of the 60s here, so a ton of echoes of the 60s. I mean, even with people like, you know, Martin Luther King and Walter Lippmann do not share, to my mind, a great many qualities except both being really smart. But I think that's the thing. A lot of people are, yes, it's, you know, it's 100 years later and there's a guy in the White House who doesn't have much experience. And so, we should all be radicals now. But it echoes throughout the history of this country since this time and indeed before this time. Right. So it's not a lesson. I don't think the book is you should read this book to get a lesson, because you're not Walter Lippmann.
Right.
And you're not John Reed.
Yeah, this is one nice thing about this. You know, so this is where Hamilton and Young Radicals sort of echo in my brain.
No question.
I got to be around Lin when he was creating Hamilton, and at the very end of that process, he asked me to write the book about the show with him.
Which is a fantastic book, by the way.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun to do it.
Oh, and, yeah.
And both of those, both of these projects, for me, come from a similar impulse, which is that American history is very, very short. And big questions that were obsessing those guys in the 1770s and 1780s are exactly the questions that we are obsessing over today. And when we fight about them, we are picking up exactly where they left off.
No question.
So the 60s and the 19-teens and the 1770s and all these eras, it's just, to me, I wanted to, as much as I could, I wanted to, in both these books, I wanted to do everything I could to emphasize the continuity of American history.
And also the frequent growing pains, these sort of really energetic growing pains that do not always turn out well. I mean, the characters in Hamilton in that time, these are nothing if not young radicals, for God's sake.
Exactly.
All right, let's talk. I want you to. All right, John Reed, who's he?
John Reed. Can I talk about him and Lipman together?
Because it helps. Yeah, okay, they went to school together.
They did go to school together. And this is what's fascinating. These guys, if you look at every fight that we have today between the centrist liberals and the left, it's all there in Walter Lippmann and John Reed, their friendship and how it ended. So Lippmann and Reed are these two classmates at Harvard. They leave in 1910. Lippmann at that point is the boy socialist. He is the one that is talking about changing society. John Reed has no politics, doesn't care about politics, can't be bothered, wants to be a poet, the thing you just read, like he's...
Let me stop you for a second. Was it Lippmann that said that John Reed seems to be his life ambition is to be arrested?
Something along
I'm paraphrasing.
He's motivated by an inordinate desire to be arrested.
Be arrested, great quote.
And what I love about their relationship is that they were both outsiders. Walter Lippmann had all the manners and all the knowledge that you needed to thrive in some place like Harvard, except he was Jewish.
Yeah.
And that always kept him on the outside. John Reed came from Oregon, which in that time might as well have been you know,
Hawaii.
Yeah, the moon. And in the course of those few years that are covered in the book, these two guys, these friends, switch places politically and then keep going. Walter Lippmann decides he doesn't want to be a socialist. He doesn't think it works. He's going to be a progressive and be responsible for some of the most emphatic statements of progressive policy. And John Reed, if anybody knows John Reed, Warren Beatty played him. And it's because he went to Russia. He watched the Russian Revolution happen. And then he went to work for Vladimir Lenin and Leon Trotsky.
And he's one of the three Americans to be buried in the Kremlin.
He's buried. He got a hero's burial under the Kremlin wall when he died. And so this unbelievable trajectory. And there are letters that show it happening, how these guys are losing their friendship. And like I said, we're there. They staked out the positions that we still have today. Is it better to be on the inside or the outside, to be realistic and incremental or shoot for the moon, even though you might not get it?
Yeah, Reed, I think, if memory serves, died in 1920, and Lippmann went on to have as influential a career as any journalist of his time.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, or ours. I mean, he today has that kind of – I mean, he was – it's amazing to look at the column that he wrote from 1931 until his death. And I found this quote I didn't know before, but President Kennedy – said at some point, vaguely exasperated, that Walter Lippmann has his own foreign policy. Sometimes it agrees with ours. So when he went abroad, you never knew what was going to happen.
Yeah, fascinating. And it always, not just in this book, Young Radicals, but it always just stuns me about how forgetful we are as a country. This book will remind you. It's a terribly exciting time. A million books have been written about the 60s and those young radicals, and you know what happened to those young radicals too. It's tough to pull it off, ladies and gentlemen. It's tough to pull it off. The guys in Hamilton did a pretty good job. Jeremy McCarter is the author of this book, Young Radicals in the War for American Ideals. It has just been printed. It's getting great reviews. I could read some of these great jacket quotes, but Ron Chernow, who is your best friend, and as you, once, as you once called him, perhaps the luckiest academic.
The happiest. He's the happiest historian.
The happiest historian in America. And Tony Kushner, too, has a great, great jacket point on this book, and you've done a remarkable job. We got to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the three other fascinating characters. Max Eastman, you may have heard of. Randolph Bourne, who fascinating guy, a kind of physically misshapen kind of character, is also fascinating. And then Alice Paul, who I knew a little bit about because I've been in love with Jane Addams for since I was a child, and they certainly knew each other. So we'll be back with Jeremy after this. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN and WGNradio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, whatever that is, I'm sure it's great. Just say play WGN Radio.
All right. Well, I don't think you're supposed to see America.
More Alan Barkas. He'll be on in a few months to talk about a show he's doing. He's also the world's greatest over 70 basketball player, which I find fascinating. I'm here for the next half hour with Jeremy McCarter, the author most recently of Young Radicals in the War for American Ideals. I've just read you a paragraph that should have you running to a bookstore if you or going online and buying books in that new fashion. It's a story of life in this country from about 1912 to the way in which it all kind of fell apart for the five radicals upon whom he focuses. John Reed, the kind of dashing Warren Beatty-like character from the movie Reds, sort of Walter Lippmann, one of the most influential journalists of his time or any time. The others in this, Max Eastman, I never knew him, but he certainly seems like a charismatic fellow.
He was. Max Eastman was the son of two ministers, not one but two. He was a poet. He was a philosophy teacher at Columbia with John Dewey. He was the
kind
last
of dashing
person.
Too. Yeah.
You know, incredibly awkward and gangly for a long time. But once he grew into his looks, everyone claims I've seen repeatedly he was compared to a Greek god because of how handsome he was.
Wow.
And yet not someone that you think is going to be the leader of a radical cause or edit a socialist magazine or potentially go to jail for 20 years for violating the Espionage Act, which is exactly what happened to Max Eastman. But what you see in Eastman is exactly this spirit that we were talking about earlier, where he was he had the soul of a poet. He wanted to write poetry. He wanted to hang out with other artists. And at the same time, he felt this desire he couldn't stop to try to correct the injustice that he saw around him. And so he, refashioned this magazine, The Masses, to
which
use
the
that.
Way you describe it, The Masses sounds like an astonishingly beautiful publication.
Yeah, it's like I think I put it in the book that one time a librarian, who I won't mention because I don't want to get her in trouble, but they're supposed to give you in a library the reprints, which are like photocopies basically. And one time somebody slipped up and gave me originals.
The original.
And it was more beautiful than any magazine that I've seen printed in my lifetime. It just was it's oversized. It's spare. It's vivid. It feels like an art magazine. And then you read the words, and the words are preaching revolution. Like they wanted, like these were socialists, and they wanted to like see society change. But also, it was hilarious. They had jokes. They had cartoons. This is what I mean about that era. There was this vibrancy that me in college and in the years since then, like we don't have that anymore.
Exactly. Well, there's no sense of humor.
Well, you can't. It just
you can't. You have to be deadly serious.
Well, Max Eastman had this. He was often criticized. There was a class war on. People would say to him, "How can you make these jokes? Why do you print these pictures just for the sake of having pretty pictures? If we're trying to win strikes and things," and he wrote back to somebody. It may have been Norman Thomas, actually. And he conceded the point. He said, "It is true that we could maybe be more useful to the cause if we cared less about life, But it is life to which this venture is dedicated.
One of the great portions of the book, Jeremy McCarter's new book, Young Radicals, is when Eastman winds up having to defend himself.
Right, and his friends.
Because his lawyer was sick, yeah. Or his lawyer ran away. His lawyer was sick, right?
The lawyer who had just failed to keep Eugene Debs out of prison, who was the best they could do on short notice, when this is when the masses, his magazine, was shut down by the Wilson administration for violating the Espionage Act. And he and John Reed and Floyd Dell and two other people were facing 20 years if they were convicted. And the only guy available to try to get them out of this trouble is Max.
Yeah.
And so he has to figure out how to defend socialism to a jury of capitalists.
Yep.
And walk free.
And see, this is what I mean, ladies and gentlemen, by the narrative drive of this book. There are all these amazing – there's a big picture here that we'll talk about too. But also it's just an exciting marvelous narrative about an exciting time filled with exciting characters and exciting events. This last of the five, of what you call a constant – no, there are two more. Randolph Bourne, who wound up dying relatively early, 1918, I think, maybe. Yeah. He was a kind of misshapen fellow, but nevertheless.
Beautiful mind, though.
No kidding.
When he was born, the doctor botched the delivery, so the forceps left him disfigured. And when he was young, he contracted an illness that twisted his spine and left him a hunchback. And yet, the most gregarious person, he had a million friends, he was an incredible conversationalist, apparently, and my God, the way he could write. You can only envy how beautifully he can put sentences together. And what I love about the guy is that he was, in the span of 5 years as a professional writer, he managed to excel at like four different things. He was the prophet of youth and gave this generation a voice. He offered a new vision of the American character based on this sort of transnational idea that we all belong here. And he attacked the war. Yeah. When it was very dangerous to insinuate there was something wrong with the war effort, Randolph Bourne was one of the few who was willing to accept any punishment to say it and then go on saying it month after month after month.
Well, and say it with, articulately and with passion, too. Right. In what I found in the book, a very effective, even moving kind of way, right, to me. Alice Paul.
And Alice Paul was just a hero and a giant. And she although quite diminutive if you saw her. I mean, yeah. This is part of her power, is she was frequently underestimated. Because she was slight, she was small, soft-spoken, but one of her associates described her as being swift and panther-like in her movements, which helped me understand what it must have been like to be in the room with this,
sure,
this amazing woman.
Sure.
She was a Quaker from New Jersey who came back from England after having spent time with the suffragettes there. And again, it was the spirit of that era. She said, if we are trying to liberate women and give them the vote after 70 years of failing to give them the vote, then we should do that, and we should do it faster. And so she led this splinter movement within women's suffrage to get a federal suffrage amendment passed.
Yeah.
And even the other suffragists who couldn't stand her had to acknowledge that that actually worked.
Yeah, she's a fascinating, fascinating character. And Jane Addams, Chicago's own, helped out with that movement.
She did.
One of the interesting things about Jane Addams, you probably came across this, was when Jane Addams wrote an essay for Good Housekeeping or Ladies' Home Journal or whatever, one of these early, how to fluff up your husband's pillow kind of magazines. And it was the most, well-read piece about why women should have the vote,
right,
ever done.
Right.
You had to live with these five for quite some time. And get to know them on a kind of intimate level. You also had to get to know Wilson a bit,
right,
Woodrow Wilson. And the gist of what happens here, I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to spoil the narrative drive of the book, is that hope winds up evaporating.
And so much more quickly than we remember today. This is what I still don't understand. I don't genuinely don't understand.
And this is something else. This is also something that echoes today, too.
Right. The rapidity. Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is – I emailed my editor I looked it up recently. It was 11:31 Chicago time on election night. This is right around the time when Pennsylvania was looking lost.
Mm.
And I emailed him and I said, I feel like I'm living my book. I also feel nauseous because this sensation I'm trying to describe in the lives of these five young people is having taken a certain kind of progress for granted, thinking you understand your country, and then something drastic happens.
That's exactly right.
Wrong.
Yeah.
And in their case, it was that. And again, I don't know why we don't talk about it more. On January 22nd, 1917, President Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, gives one of the great addresses of American history. It's his Peace Without Victory address.
Mm-hmm.
He has reached out to the combatant powers who have been slaughtering each other for 3 years at that point.
Yep.
To say that the United States is willing to assist with fashioning a peace that will end this war. But it is incumbent on him as the president to state the terms under which the United States will do this. The vision that he sets forward is to fashion a peace that will last forever. He says that the United States is not interested in ceasing to be a great neutral power if it's just going to create a new balance of power afterwards. What he wants to create is what he calls a community of power.
Yeah.
So in 1917, he's talking about something like the United Nations.
United Nations, sure.
And he's talking about the United States fulfilling its role, the purpose of its founding, not to go have a huge army and fight the other huge armies, but to only be a peacekeeper at the scale of these great world powers in a world that's rapidly shrinking. That's January 22nd. 9 days later, the Germans say they're going to resume unrestricted submarine warfare. A few weeks after that, the Germans insanely, stupidly try to convince Mexico to attack the United States.
Yeah, I know. That is so strange. Yeah.
It's just absurd.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
Absurd is the word you're in.
And Woodrow Wilson, who had insisted that he wanted peace without victory and wanted to keep the United States out of it, decides 9 weeks after that speech that the United States has to fight and that we have to go to war now to make the world safe for democracy. And that gap is the tiny, tiny peak of the arc of American promise, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of its role in the world.
Oh, same here. We've got to take a little break, then we'll have a few more minutes. I hope I am compelling you to buy Young Radicals. It's exciting, but it also, it ripples now. It echoes now. It echoes backward, and it echoes to tomorrow. We'll be right back. You'll be hearing Alan Barkus for like the next we've reconnected, and he's a grand talent. He wrote the original Cub song before they were no longer mad at Steve Goodman and readopted Go Cubs Go. And Alan was a great friend of Steve Goodman's. Blah, blah, blah. I have about 7 minutes left with Jeremy McCarter. We could literally talk about his book, Young Radicals, In the War for American Ideals. For hours, and I could read you other portions of the book. I read you just a short portion about John Reed that should have given you a great example of what an exciting, exciting book this is. This is not a heavy 800-page academic treatise. It is a compelling story of a time that you don't have to be an academic to see how interesting and despair-filled the time he's writing about is. Everything changed. You're polishing the book at the time of the election in January.
Yeah. From 2011, when I started writing the book, until dinner time on November 8th, 2016, I had one idea about what I was doing. I thought I was writing about this episode in the progress of America's ideals.
Yeah.
And I thought that we were about to enter another one.
Mm-hmm.
And that election just completely changed the way I think about the country, but it also changed the book.
Yeah.
So that night I threw out my introduction, which is about, you know, the purpose of the introduction is to be the intersection where the reader meets the story.
Yeah.
And the reader is now coming from a completely different direction, sure. So I had to rewrite the introduction, and that was hard because it was
I'll bet.
You know, it's not as cheerful as it used to be, that's for sure. And that was hard, but then luckily, Random House wanted the manuscript for me in early February, which meant that I got to hang on to it just long enough
to
rewrite the epilogue too, throw out the epilogue and make it acknowledge that the activism that's suddenly around the country, the Women's March, the way that people are going to the airports to protest the travel ban,
yeah.
That this thing that I've been trying to excavate from our past suddenly, you know,
is everywhere.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's been around. I mean, to be sure, like, God knows. But suddenly you've got 4 million people taking to the streets on the day after. Yeah. I mean, that's
astonishing. I mean, it's never gone. It's never, you know, it pops up when the ground for bad reasons becomes nurturing for it, when it is, it's like kind of Superman. When it's needed, the radicalism will arise from very certainly needed in the 60s. And I think the same is true now. You hope for, at least I do, you hope that the voices, the lead voices, are as smart. And as, I mean, some of them are a little nutty, but as smart and passionate as some of the voices of your young radicals, is that not your hope too?
Absolutely. Yeah. And what's exciting is that I think you can draw a pretty direct line from Alice Paul and the National Women's Party to the Women's March that just happened. I mean, Alice Paul began her suffrage crusade with a march down Pennsylvania Avenue. And what's exciting about it is that, you know, the thing that people criticize Alice Paul for, even at her time, was the way that she was willing to try to appease white supremacists because she thought she would need Southern votes to get the 19th Amendment passed. And you can see how now the Women's March is never going to go there. That the understanding of what it takes to have a diverse working coalition now is like its starting point is more sophisticated about this stuff than the Women's Party could get to by the 1920s.
Sure. The changing face of the country, though, is something that troubles me today, in that, and the changing face of race in this country has always been screwed up. I mean, always been screwed up. And it seems these days even more divisive than ever, and likely to get more so. So that to me is sort of troubling. And the whole notion of there's a lot of America can be hospitable to hope, but hope has to also be transmitted to action, don't you think?
I do.
I mean, that's certainly. I mean, I don't want to get into a philosophical discussion.
It's not philosophical at all.
11 o'clock at night.
No, but when better, right?
Yeah,
but I think. But no. One thing that these looking at the Hamilton's era for that book and looking at the coming of age era for young radicals is that if you think of hope as a condition, as a feeling, then it's useless.
Yeah, absolutely.
If hope isn't a step towards action, then it doesn't do anybody any good.
See, I think back to the people, many of whom were in the Women's March, because I was out there asking, they sat at home on election night hoping that Hillary Clinton would be there. The difference between that and going to a ballot box, as they used to say in the old days, that one is empty and the other is action. Right.
Yeah, you know, the other nice thing about seeing these two eras is the founding era and the 19-teens, and now is that you see how the system has been tested, right? In the past, like James Madison and the other founders set up a system that they thought would get us through.
Yeah,
they thought that we would resist tyranny, that we would find a way to figure out all our issues, and I don't know that we've ever been tested the way that we're being tested right now.
I agree.
So I see it every day as, is the system going to hold? And one of the things that makes the system hold is this continued activism, the sense that people aren't going to put up with this. Like these five in the 19-teens, they're going to stand up for what they believe in.
And we will see what happens. We hope things don't explode in the way that that they exploited under President Wilson, because in many ways the whole, and this is, you know, it's a very Chicago phrase, I suppose, is, you know, the, one of the leitmotifs of this, of Young Radicals, one of the most readable historical books I've ever read, is that, you know, you can't fight City Hall. Do you know what I mean, Jeremy?
Yeah.
You can't fight City Hall. A lot of these people wound up losers.
Yeah, they
do. It's hard to think of Walter Lippmann as being a loser, but, you know, when you reach for the stars and someone comes along and moves them away or blows them up,
right,
you wind up in some kind of despair, is a word you use in the book.
You know, it's funny. A friend asked me, pointed out the fact that, you know, these idealists, you know, they end up disappointed or downcast somehow, and asked me something about how I'd chosen that. I didn't quite think it through in the moment, but I've thought about it a lot since then, because of course an idealist is going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the world.
Look at Jesus.
Pursuing an ideal worthy of the name could look at the world today and say, well, I'm feeling good about things today. I think we're definitely getting where we need to go. There's always more that we have to do in this country, more than most, because they set these ideals so high.
Yeah.
As I say in the book, it's that it's a relay race. So they had their fight. We pick up where they left off.
No question.
With the same banners in some cases.
That's right.
And we just have to try to do better than they did.
Well, you know that he's smart if you've been listening in the last hour, but no two that he can really write. Young Radicals in the War for American Ideals. It stars five remarkably compelling characters about whom you know very little, probably, and about who and who you will never, ever forget. Jeremy McCarter. You can go to jeremymccarter.com and pick up that other book if they still have any available. I'm sure there are.
They got a handful, I'm
makes
sure.
Makes it easy. I can't wait for your next book and see what that is. Jeremy, it's great. Best to the family.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Rob.
Who's coming on? Carl Amari's coming on later. Lise Graham's the world's greatest producer. Aubrey Mumpower is by far the world's greatest engineer, but he knows that. Lise is still learning what a great producer she is. See you next Sunday. I have no idea who's going to be on next Sunday, July 2nd. Maybe we'll just replay this Jeremy McCarter interview, because I want people to buy this book. If that reading of the John Reed beginning of the chapter didn't sound like something like, you know, out of James Patterson, but better written, then you're crazy.